Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Weekly. It's Wednesday, September 10th, 2025. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. We'll chat about The Conjuring Last Rites. We'll have a spoiler-filled conversation about the new TV show The Paper, and we'll present a quick interview with a couple of that show's cast members. And we'll round things out with a conversation about Spike Lee's newest film, Highest to Lowest. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com. And joining me for the news segment, we have Slash Film staff writer Ryan Scott.
Hey, everyone. How's it going?
All right, Ryan. So Paramount, which is now being overseen by David Ellison and Skydance, is making some more moves. So Will Smith has signed a first look deal with the studio, and Paramount has also signed a 3-year distribution deal with Legendary Pictures. So next summer, Paramount is going to be releasing the upcoming Street Fighter movie that Legendary has been working on. And I want to make it clear that Legendary still has some carve-outs with Warner Brothers projects, like the sequel to a Minecraft movie and movies like Godzilla X Kong Supernova and the third Dune film, whenever those end up coming out. But Paramount is going to be its proper studio partner for the next 3 years. So what do you make of this move on Paramount's part here?
It's a great move for Paramount. Legendary is one of the best free agents out there. Like, as far as, you know, Skydance was kind of that way, but I always viewed Legendary as a bit more of a better creative partner. Like, if you look at Legendary's output from the Jurassic World films to, you know, a lot of, like, they are a producer on the Dark Knight trilogy. And, you know, I mean, they really do have, like, I know that, like, you know, those movies hail from, like, Warner Brothers or these other studios. Sorry, but when Legendary attaches its name to something, it really does tend to mean something. So I think this is, you know, this is a good move. It's a really good move for Paramount. I really see Paramount, like, putting their money where their mouth is as far as going, we're going to put our, okay, I'm going to avoid the gross metaphor. We're going to put our foot in the dirt and say, you know, hey, we really are trying to become a filmmaker friendly studio here. And we want to, you know, because I think they're seeing that work with Warner Brothers, right? Like, it is working with Warner Brothers. And so, you know, I think it's smart, and I love Legendary. I think that, you know, and it's good for Legendary to go, hey, let's test the waters with what else is out there. Can there be a better deal? Can we do other interesting things with different studios? Like, it makes sense to me. And, you know, Warner Brothers has a lot going on right now. They've signed other filmmakers to deals and things like that. So I think that, you know, obviously they'll still have the MonsterVerse at Legendary with Legendary and stuff. But as far as new development stuff goes, it feels like Warner Brothers' priorities are elsewhere right now. So to me, Paramount seems like a great home for them.
Cool. So in terms of upcoming movies as well, there's a Bluey movie that's coming to theaters on August 6th, 2027, which will likely be competing with Secret Wars, Shrek 5, and Frozen 3 for the biggest movie of that year. I don't know if we have much more to say about this, but I just feel like this has got to be a gigantic hit incoming, right?
Well, you saying that, like, I think that because a lot of our audience, like, let's face it, like, 8-year-old kids aren't listening to this podcast, I don't think. If you are, hello, kids. but you know, if you're not, like, a parent with, like, a young kid, you do not, and I'm not either, but, like, you don't understand how big Bluey is. Bluey is massive. And so you saying that, like, anyone's impulse is to go, wait, bigger than Secret Wars, bigger than Shrek 5, are you crazy? No, this is like Minecraft movie level stuff. Like, I do believe that. You know, I just do think 2027 is, I wish they could get it out sooner, because you are going to have some kids age out of caring about it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it has, whether or not it is bigger than Shrek 5, it's going to be massive. And looking at that 2027 slate, the way it's developing, could be huge.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. So next up, this story really took me by surprise. I had to, like, do a double take when I
think you and I both had the most extreme reactions to this when it broke.
So there's a sequel to The Last Witch Hunter, which is being, it's in development, and Vin Diesel is going to be coming back to reprise his role. And Michael Caine, who starred in that first film along with Vin Diesel, is going to be coming out of retirement to co-star in this movie again. So I was just completely baffled by this because I did not see The Last Witch Hunter. My understanding was that it was just another kind of fluff movie that didn't really make much of an impact. But according to Deadline, it's one of the top five most watched movies on Netflix, which I don't know if they got that stat completely right, because that just seems that seems extremely difficult for me to believe. And
well,
Deadline
I don't think
is
they
not
mean,
always accurate with stuff like that. But
I don't think they mean all time. I think they meant like because it recently was on Netflix again, like after being away for a while. So I think they meant like it jumped back into the top 10.
Okay. So that story came out yesterday as we're recording this, and I looked this morning just to see if it was still in the top 10, and it's not. So I was wondering if they had access to some other data that we don't. Either way, just the idea that The Last Witch Hunter is getting a sequel all these years later is very surprising to me. So yeah, it sounds like you were equally shocked.
I was, but my memory of it is that it was more expensive than it was, because I remember it being a big flop, and let's be clear, theatrically it was. It had a budget as high as $90 million. It was distributed by Lionsgate, made 147 worldwide, which is by no means a success. But in 2015, the landscape is a little different. You could make a little bit more on the ancillary market. Lionsgate always sells overseas rights and stuff. So, you know, like, but it has consistently performed on streaming, and I can see a world where over the life of the movie that it actually made money. The only thing I'll say about this is that The Last Witch Hunter is very enjoyable, ill-advised, bad cinema. Like, I'm not even a fantasy guy, but it is like a really fun, bad watch. Like, I can't defend it as a good movie, but it is like weirdly fun. But I think you and I the only thing I'll say is Michael Caine, he can do whatever he wants. Like, few people in cinema have earned the right to be like, you do whatever the hell you want. The way Michael Caine has. I just wish he was coming out of retirement for something other than this. But hey, whatever, man. If Vin Diesel was able to convince him of this, good for you.
Yeah, and I think he's going to be in his 90s. I want to say
he's 92 right now.
So. Yeah, wow.
He can't really walk on his own. He's in a wheelchair. Like, you know, there was a picture of him and I guess him and Vin are friends, which is weird, but they were like out to dinner. Like, there was like paparazzi pictures of like Vin Diesel pushing him around in his wheelchair. Like, it was actually kind of sweet.
That's so sweet. That's so nice.
There is something weirdly charming to me about the idea of like Vin Diesel and Michael Caine, like being friends. So like, I don't know, like, let's say that was the bridge. Like, let's say Vin Diesel's like, I finally got them to make, cause like, we know Vin Diesel gets passionate about these weird things like the Riddick movies and apparently this, and like, he's just like, come on, man, like, do this thing with me. And like, Michael Caine's like, okay, for you, my friend, Vin Diesel. Like, I want to believe that it was something like that. Like, that makes it like deeply charming, but we'll see.
Yeah, I hope they like strap Michael Caine to the back of a dragon or something in this movie. he's coming out of retirement, like, let him go out with a bang, you know, like, do something wild. So
yeah, the cast for that movie though was crazy. Like, you had like Elijah Wood, you had Rose Leslie, who was kind of big at the time, like. I don't know. I mean, it was like a weird, like, such a weird thing. What a weird movie. Anyway.
Okay, so The Conjuring Last Rites completely dominated the box office this past weekend. We don't really need to get into a lot of that. I'll just say it overtook the first It as being, what, the highest grossing opening weekend for any horror movie? Is that the stat?
That is correct. So it opened to $190 million worldwide when it opened in 2017. That felt like the biggest pop cultural moment ever at the time. And The Conjuring Last Rites seemingly just glided its way to $194 million worldwide, which was $84 million domestic and $110 million overseas. So, yeah, I mean, just incredible. I mean, truly remarkably incredible stuff. You cannot say anything but like just good stuff about Warner Brothers and anybody involved. You don't get to that level of anything by accident. That's just incredible work.
Yeah. So if people want to hear you and I break that down in great detail, they can go to patreon.com/popcultured with a D and subscribe to the corresponding tier to hear the weekly box office conversations that we have over there. Speaking of The Conjuring, though, there's an HBO Max series that is going to be set in the Conjuring universe that now has a showrunner. And it's Nancy Wan, who has worked on Jessica Jones and Little Fires Everywhere and Supernatural. She's going to be leading the show creatively. And Peter Cameron and Cameron Squires have been hired as writers. Peter Cameron worked on Werewolf by Night, Agatha All Along, and Moon Knight. So definitely a Marvel veteran there. And then Cameron Squires wrote for Gen V Season 2, the Prime Video show, and then the Star Wars series, The Acolyte. James Wan's Atomic Monster is producing this show. Peter Safran is executive producing. He, I believe, produced all of the Conjuring movies. So that seems like that show is taken off. This is definitely like the biggest step forward it's had. I want to say it's been in development for a little while now, but it seems like it's kind of taking shape there. So anybody who is interested in the Conjuring universe and wants to see what that looks like extended into the realm of television, probably won't have to wait much longer to see that. Is this something that you're interested in, Ryan? I know you've talked about before that you're not like a huge TV person, but you do love horror. So is this something you would kind of make an exception for?
Yeah, it all depends on timing, right? Like there's TV shows that I want to watch that I just, because of time, end up not becoming a priority. But this is one, depending on how it shakes out, I would watch. And especially having just watched The Conjuring Last Rites, like, I don't want to spoil anything, but you do sort of see some flashbacks of a young Ed and Lorraine Warren. And, you know, like, they're I could see that, like, you know, case of the week type stuff. And yeah, I mean, I would totally. And it also makes a lot of sense, right? Like, because even in Conjuring Last Rites, again, not spoiling much, but there's a point where Ed Warren is like, we've had over 1,000 cases. And it's like, mm-hmm. Yeah, come on. You could easily do an X-Files Monster of the Week type thing with the Warrens, and like, why not? If especially if they make it where it is more of like a Monster of the Week type show instead of a big through line, like, I think that would be more fun. That's me pitching, not so much saying whether or not I'd watch it, but I think I'm more interested in that scenario. But we'll see how it shakes out.
Yeah, people will hear me and Chris Evangelista and Jeremy Mathai talk about this in a little bit. We actually recorded that segment a couple days ago before this news broke. So if we say anything that's immediately out of date, I apologize, but just throwing that on people's radar before we dive into that. A couple more news stories here, Ryan. David F. Sandberg, who is a director that I know you have a great fondness for, is going to be directing a new Amityville horror movie with several Conjuring veterans helping to get that film made. Ian Goldberg and Richard Niang, who wrote The Conjuring Last Rites, are writing the script. Peter Safran, who we mentioned produces the Conjuring movies, is going to be producing. And then, of course, Sandberg himself directed Annabelle Creation. So what do you think about the pairing of this director with the Amityville horror franchise material?
David F. Sandberg, in the realm of horror, I will follow to the ends of the earth. I think Lights Out is a brilliantly fun little monster-like movie of sorts, like a supernatural monster movie. I think even the short that Lights Out is based on, if you haven't watched it, is stupid good. I seem to be in the minority of thinking the Until Dawn movie was genuinely great. If it's horror, I have no theoretical interest in another Amityville horror movie, but when you put him on it, I'm suddenly interested. Like, he is the reason I care. I will pretty much watch whatever he does. So, yeah, like, for me, it's purely like him doing horror. I will watch it. It's plain and simple. Okay.
Excellent. All right. So this is kind of a one for me story, but a sequel is in the works to the upcoming reboot of Cliffhanger. I think I've talked about this on the podcast before. I'm very excited about this new movie, which stars Lily James and Pierce Brosnan. It's directed by Wam Colette Sarah, and it takes place in the Dolomite Mountains in Italy. And we don't know much more about it than that. I think there is a log line out there somewhere about like those characters kind of being thrust into action when a billionaire's son comes to stay at their fancy mountain resort. And then there's a kidnapping or something like that. But there has not been a trailer released for this movie as we speak quite yet. I'm hoping for that any day now because I'm really eager to see this. But now a sequel is being developed for this movie that hasn't even come out yet. So I guess that speaks highly of either the quality of the movie, or this is just like a pure cynical thing that the producers are like putting this story out there that they're wanting to work on a sequel because they think it'll juice some interest in the upcoming reboot. Yeah. So
how dare you assume this is just for you when you're speaking with me on the podcast, that like a Lily James Pierce Brosnan 90s action reboot. Yeah, no, this has me written all over it. I think Waimea Colette Serra is a fantastic mid-budget director. Also a really nice guy. I've interviewed him a couple times. He's a little shy, but also weird anecdotal thing. The 1 year I was at Comic-Con interviewing people, David F. Sandberg was there for Shazam Fury of the Gods. And was there for Black Adam, and I, but just them sort of both going in this weird directions. But yeah, I do think it's interesting that like Cliffhanger was a big hit in its day, never got a sequel, getting rebooted like 30 years later, and then they're just like, cool, let's just turn this into a franchise now for some reason. really hoping Pierce Brosnan is playing the John Lithgow sort of role this time around. Yeah. Also, if you haven't seen Cliffhanger either ever or in a while, boy, I can't recommend it enough. Like, it is weirder than you remember. Like, the central plot of it all is like so fantastically dumb. But it works so well because like everybody commits to it. Like nobody believes they're in a bad movie. Like everyone believes they're in like a real movie. And yeah, it's just so fun. So I'm hoping they can kind of capture that same vibe here.
And that opening scene rips, man. That's still so
great.
Opening
scene is so good. But then it devolves into, on the odd chance you haven't seen it, the actual reason for that movie existing, like the actual plot thing, is so hilariously stupid. I love it so much. yeah, like it is, but like again, it's because everybody commits to it, right? Like nobody's winking at the camera. Like everyone believes they're in that, like they believe it, and it really works. Yeah.
Okay, so last news story here. AMC Theaters is offering horror fans something called a Slash Pass, which costs $66.66, and it basically gives people the ability to see six movies between now and the end of this year. And the idea is that they'll spend it on horror movies. I think they're limiting which films are eligible for this. So I think I don't think you can use it for just anything. But this is kind of a cool deal for horror fans. And you've got Conjuring Last Rites. You've got The Long Walk that's coming out soon. You've got Good Boy. You've got a small movie called Bone Lake. You've got Black Phone 2. There's Five Nights at Freddy's 2. There's like a lot of
There's a lot of smaller horror coming out too throughout the rest of the year. So
yeah, and apparently I was reading about this on Hollywood Reporter. This can also be redeemed for a few classic horror titles that are coming to more than 200 AMC locations this October, including A Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, Candyman, Scream, and Terrifier. So that'll be a pretty cool way for people to see those movies on the big screen if they've never seen those before.
Yeah, my understanding, the Nightmare on Elm Street, like the Alamo Drafthouse right now, they just upgraded all of the Elm Street movies on 4K for the first time. So they have a big box set coming out. But like the Alamo Drafthouse right now is playing all of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies in 4K. And my understanding is that the AMC repertory screening is going to be of the 4K release as well. Way worth it if you can, yeah, you know. It's an interesting idea, right? Like it's an interesting idea to sort of try to goose some sales, right? For because horror has been really reliable this year and people are turning out, and you know, it's an interesting idea that because horror, I think people tend to go to it because if you can, there's a crowd element. There really is an element of if you see a good horror movie with a crowd, it really plays better. So the idea of kind of being able to like galvanize that audience is it's a decent deal too, right? Like 11-ish bucks per movie. Like, I don't know. I like the idea of experimentation. Like I like the idea of, you know, hey, let's make movies cheaper on Wednesday. Let's try this. Like I'm all for it. Like, let's do it. AMC is, I've said many times, my last choice if I'm going to go see a movie, but, I appreciate they are the biggest theater chain in the world. Like, you got to lead the way. So experiment. And if it works, you know, good. Other people might follow.
Yeah, very much on the same page about that. They don't have to do this, and I'm glad they are, because I think they're, well, I don't know. Maybe you could argue that they do have to do this because things aren't going great for the theatrical industry right now, you know?
Yeah, so, this is opening up another conversation, but yes, theaters absolutely must experiment. Like, this is the time to not rest on, like, you must try new things, period.
Yeah.
There's a very good episode of the Town podcast recently, not to promote someone else's stuff, but where Adam Aaron, the CEO of AMC, had like an hour long conversation with Matt Bologna and Lucas Shaw of Bloomberg, and was pretty honest about a lot of stuff. And you know, you kind of get a window into their thinking and what they're trying to do to innovate and what they're trying to do, you know, because if AMC fails, like, the industry fails, right? Like, whether or not I like them is irrelevant. It's they mm-hmm. are the leader in the clubhouse. So you know, they what their success is sort of pointing to the industry's success. So, you know, that's, I'm doing nothing if not rooting for AMC.
Definitely. Yeah. And just for people who are hearing about this for the first time, with this Slash Pass thing, you can redeem your 6 admissions across multiple titles, or you could bring 5 friends and apply all 6 to the same movie, or you can mix and match any way you want in between there. So they're at least providing people with a little bit of flexibility in how they're trying to get this thing going, which I think is smart and a good way to approach that as well. So yeah, that's going to do it for the news segment. Ryan, where can people find you online?
You fine folks can find me online at Ryan Scott Writes, the word writes, W-R-I-T-E-S, at Blue Sky and Threads, where I'm most active. You can also find me on Instagram, but it's mostly me just posting pictures of me miserable after a long run. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Cool. All right. Thanks, Ryan.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
With me now to talk about The Conjuring Last Rites, we have Slash Film editor and chief film critic Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
And Slash Film staff writer Jeremy Mathai.
Hey, folks. Thanks for having me.
All right, guys, let's get into this. I have not seen this movie yet, but Chris, I want to start with you. I know you're a big fan of the Conjuring universe, and or specifically, I know you really like the Ed and Lorraine Warren movies starring Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga. So what did you think about Last Rites?
Yeah, I like the main movie starring them as the Warrens, and I like this a lot. It's a little bloated. It's a little overstuffed. The family they help here is a little underdeveloped. Like, of all the families they've helped so far in these movies, this one gets like the least amount of like development. They're just kind of like there. But the emotional angle really worked for me here. Like, they really lean hard into the emotional element. And that's what I like about these movies. Like, what I like about the series is that it really plays up the love story between Ed and Lorraine. And this one really leans into that while also enhancing, the relationship with their daughter, Judy, who's older now. And she's also getting married, so she has her own love story. And I'm kind of jaded to, I've seen so many horror movies that I don't really get scared by horror, but I can recognize when the scares are fun, and I found them to be pretty enjoyable here. There's a scene where Judy is like trying on a wedding dress in this cramped room surrounded by mirrors that's really well staged. I had a good time with this. It's not my favorite of the films, but I thought it was pretty good.
Jeremy, what'd you think about it?
Yeah, I think I was a little less positive on this than Chris was. Just for some context, like, I'm not that big of a horror fan. I'm probably, like, the least adept at this genre on the slash film team, but I have always enjoyed the Conjuring movies. You know, mostly the mainline ones, as Chris mentioned, but even, like, you know, I kind of dug The Nun and The Nun 2, both of which, I think Michael Chavis, who also directed Last Rites and the previous one, he directed both of those as well, so... You know, they can't quite, you know, reach the same heights of the James Wan, the first and the second installments for me. And, you know, there's just something about those first two movies where, you know, obviously a lot of it is kind of carried on the back of, you know, Patrick Wilson, Vera Farmiga. And, you know, there's that moment in, I think it was the second one where Patrick Wilson, he's just strumming on his guitar for that one scene. And it's just like, you're watching these movies expecting to get scared out of your mind. And it's like, oh, these are actually really wholesome and sweet. If you kind of lay aside the real world aspects of it, of the two characters who are obviously based on, you know, two paranormal investigators. And that's kind of, I think that kind of feeds into why Last Rites didn't really hit as hard for me. I hate using this complaint. It didn't feel as scary for me as I kind of wanted it to. And I wrote a whole piece on Slash Film that should be coming up. It's either published or will be soon, about how this movie kind of leans a little too much towards brushing away or kind of ignoring the real world aspects of just how controversial these figures were in real life. And the whole movie, you know, it has that sort of Avengers Endgame feel to it of trying to wrap up this whole franchise in a neat and tidy bow. And a lot of that just didn't really sink in for me as much as it really should have. So I was a little disappointed in this one. It's not an outright disaster by any means. And I am genuinely happy to see it raking in as much money as it did this past weekend.
Yeah, I think as we're recording that it's the second highest grossing horror movie opening of all time. And it, when all of the numbers are tallied, it might end up topping the first It movie. So, Chris, I wanted to ask you about the end of this film, and without getting into any spoilers or anything, but just that sense of finality that Jeremy alluded to, it's been a huge centerpiece of the marketing in this movie. You know, the final movie starring the Warrens, basically. I think Jacob has theorized that there might be a young Warrens movie coming, especially after this movie made as much money as it did. But were you satisfied by the conclusion of that emotional arc that you talked about because of this movie's placement as being supposedly the final film in the Warren saga?
You know, it's really conflicting to touch on what Jeremy was talking about. In my review, I actually opened my review with this, where I talk about how I'm really torn with these movies because I really love the fictional version of the Warrens played by Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga. I just love that version of them, but the real life versions, at best, I think they were naive. At worst, I think they were con artists. So it's really conflict. Like these movies make them out to be like saints, basically, like these selfless people who went above and beyond to help everyone fight demons and stuff like that. So it's really it's hard to like put those feelings aside. Like when I'm watching these movies, like I love this fictional version of them and I want nothing but good things for them. But you read up on the real version of the Warrens and it's kind of like, man, I don't know. Like, am I sort of like aiding and abetting the not so great things the real versions did by celebrating this fictional one? Cause like the way this one ends, without giving away how it ends, it's very much wraps up with being like, and they lived happily ever after, and that's what they deserved because they were great people. And it's like, all right, the fictional versions were great people, but the real ones, I don't know. I don't know if they really deserved a happy ending. So it's really tough to say, man. Like I love the fictional ones. The fictional ones, they're my ghost hunting parents. I love them. But without going into too many details, like there were allegations made against like the real Ed Warren that he like sexually abused a young woman who was living with the Warrens for a while. The real Lorraine denied it happening, but you know, those allegations are out there. So like it's really unsettling when you read about the real Warrens and how they we're not the best people. And then you watch these movies where they're the nicest people you'll ever likely meet. So I really don't know how I feel about it. It's hard to, you know, you got to separate the art from the artist, I guess. And you gotta hold, like, I know the marketing slaps, like, this is a true story all over it, but like, it's obviously not. but yeah, I don't know what they're going to do now, because this movie actually opens with two different actors playing young versions of Ed and Lorraine in a flashback in the 60s. I had actually read that they were going to digitally de-age Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga, and Vera Farmiga actually suggested they just use younger actors instead. And that's probably a good idea rather than doing digital de-aging, but I'm really going to hate if they use the young actors now going forward, because like there's no way, and this movie has made so much money, there's no way they're going to end the series here. But the secret sauce is Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga. Like, what I like about these movies is the chemistry those actors have together. Like, I don't want to watch different actors playing these characters. I want to watch them, you know? So I don't really know how excited I'll be about a new franchise with like the young Warrens, you know? I don't know how I'll react to that.
Jeremy, before I ask you about your thoughts about the future of this franchise, do you have any ideas of how this movie could have ended in a way that grappled with the real life legacy of the Warrens while also wrapping up the story it needed to wrap up here? Like, you're talking about being a little dissatisfied with how this movie kind of hand waved away the real life version, but is there a scenario that you can envision where it would have satisfied you by addressing the real life version in some way?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I did spend a lot of time thinking about that. And I think what I arrived on was it invites all of these questions that I don't think viewers really need to be thinking about, just because it goes so over the top and almost just heaping all this praise on these, you know, obviously the fictional versions of these characters, but in a way that makes you think of like, oh, but this isn't what the real life characters were by any means whatsoever. And I think it just goes a little too over the top on that, when it could have just toned things down a little bit. I understand that it kind of has to wrap up this franchise in an almost Avengers Endgame way, or I'm going to make a really weird comparison here now. It really reminded me of something like the last James Bond movie, No Time to Die, where it's like, spoilers for that movie, I guess, but like you're watching James Bond die in this horrific like missile strike, and it, like the music is swelling and they're treating this like it's Tony Stark sacrifice or something. And I'm just watching this and I'm like, when did we get to the point where we have to raise these fictional characters on such a high pedestal where we're like worshiping them to this extent, when you could just, you know, there's ways to kill off these characters or wrap up their emotional arcs in a satisfying way without dialing it up all the way, way past 10 to like, and I felt like Last Rites kind of did that in the end too. I'm not going to spoil any specifics or anything, but just the way it kind of wraps up, there's a bit of ending text too that really rubbed me the wrong way, where the fact that it almost acknowledges the real life versions of the Warrens by kind of just going, yes, their actions and their lives were deemed controversial or something like that, but, and then it goes right back to, you know, making them out to be the most important figures in history. So that sort of stuff definitely rubbed me the wrong way.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So what do you think, Jeremy, about the idea of continuing this franchise in some way, whether that's going backwards, or I guess the possibility is there after this movie made so much money to pick back up and cast Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga again and continue on with another story? Like, what would you like to see going forward?
What I would like to see is the studio going, yes, we ended this franchise on a high note, let's not do anymore. But obviously in the reality that we live in, that's not going to happen. So I understand that, like Chris said, and Jacob has posited, it's all pretty much a guarantee that they're going to go the young Ed and Lorraine route with those new characters. And it just seems destined to fail, if you ask me. It feels like the sort of thing that like is, you know, in this streaming age, it's going to end up like an HBO Max, like miniseries or something. And that's just the last thing I really want to see. I've enjoyed this franchise despite my hangups with Last Rites and even the previous one, The Devil Made Me Do It. But I don't know, this just seems completely destined to fail, if you ask me. But, you know, that's the reality we're living in. That's 100% the route they're going to go. So I guess I have to make my peace with it.
Yeah. Chris, do you think there's a way to continue this story forward on the timeline without going back and recasting younger versions of these characters, because there's just like so much lore surrounding the cinematic versions of these characters. Like I saw, I think the first Conjuring movie, I've maybe seen one or two other movies in this whole Conjuring universe, but I remember there being a room that they have that has all these different relics and well, what would you call them?
Cursed objects.
Yeah, exactly. Cursed objects. And so this room has all these different things in there, and they've already spun off, obviously, the Annabelle stuff into its own franchise. Do you think there's maybe the way forward is just to continue spinning off different versions of those cursed objects into getting into being the centerpiece of their own movie?
Yeah, that's honestly what I would like to see. Like my, even though I, like I said, I prefer the main Conjuring movies in this franchise, my favorite film in this series has come to be Annabelle Comes Home, which has the Warrens in like sort of a cameo. That movie is about the Warrens' daughter Judy and her two babysitters. They accidentally unleash Annabelle, and Annabelle unleashes all the cursed objects from that room, and like they all like go crazy in the house. And it's just a very silly, very fun, like haunted house movie. And that's the direction they should go, where it's just like more of those cursed objects get their own movies. Because that room is filled with like thousands of things. Like even in this, in Last Rites, there's a scene where Tony, who's Judy's fiance, asks Ed Warren, he's like, how many cases have you investigated? And he says like thousands. So like there's literally thousands of objects in that room. Like just go nuts with that. You don't have to have the young Warrens. You can just have spin-off movies. Go nuts. You know, don't give me new actors playing the Warrens. Just have all those cursed objects. I mean, they set up a bunch of stuff in that Annabelle Comes Home movie that they could spin off. Like there's a thing called like The Ferryman, which is like a ghost serial killer. Like, give me a movie about that. I will happily watch that movie. Like, you know, like just.
That sounds pretty rad. Okay, yeah. So final question. Jeremy, was there a moment from Last Rites that stands out to you, either good or bad, just something that you think you're going to be thinking about when you conjure up imagery of this movie, you know, 5 years from now or something? Is there like a particular moment that stands out to you that isn't like too spoilery that you can highlight here?
So since I skewed mostly negative during this talk, I will highlight a positive moment, which was Patrick Wilson as Ed Warren. There's kind of a new dynamic in this movie with the Warren's daughter, Judy. She has a boyfriend in this. He's the new presence in the family. He's kind of invading their turf a little bit in there. And some of the best moments in the movie are Patrick Wilson going full dad mode on this poor young man who has no idea what he's in for. He knows the Warrens by reputation, what they sort of do, but he's smart enough not to ask too many questions about exactly what they do. So he's going into this kind of little wide-eyed, a little innocent, and Patrick Wilson dials up the dad meter just to full blast. And those are some of the funniest moments in the movie, where he's just obviously just toying with this poor kid and kind of, you know, obviously being overly protective of his daughter. And that's kind of the emotional arc of the movie as well. But some of the best moments of humor, I think, were definitely relying on what's worked with this franchise to this point, which is chemistry between the lead actors and the way that they interact with the side characters and stuff. So I very much appreciated that, at least.
Excellent. All right, Chris, same question. Any highlights that you're going to be thinking about for a while?
I agree with Jeremy that I love the dad moments here. There's a great little moment where like they just play ping pong, and it's like, this isn't scary. This is just like a normal, happy moment. In terms of like horror moments, there's that mirror moment I already mentioned. And I really like this moment where one of the kids of the haunted family is watching a home video, and she keeps rewinding and pausing it because she's trying to catch something. And I thought that was a really cool way to use like old tech, because the movie is set in 1986. Like, so obviously if she was watching it on like a computer, she could easily just use like the slider to slide to the moment she wants to get to and pause it there. But because she's using like an old VCR and a VHS tape, she has to like painstakingly keep rewinding and fast forwarding and hitting pause at the wrong spot. And it builds like a lot of tension. And I thought that was a really clever way of like bringing like old technology into the scare to the scenes. I was really impressed with that moment.
Excellent. All right, cool. Well, yeah, The Conjuring Last Rites is in theaters right now, so check that out if you're interested. Thank you very much, guys. Appreciate it. Joining me now to talk about the new series, The Paper, we have Slash Film editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
Brad, I know you're a big, big fan of The Office, the American version. You're probably a big fan of the original British version too, right?
Indeed, I am.
Okay, so this is the first official full-blown spin-off of The Office. It's actually kind of a continuation in some ways. We're going to have a full spoiler conversation about this just because I feel like people kind of know The Paper exists. It's streaming on Peacock. It's a spinoff of The Office. We can't really talk much more about the show in broad terms without potentially giving things away for people who might be interested in watching it. It's not really a show that it's more of a hangout show. It's very much like The Office in that way. So it's not like there are any major plot turns or anything that we're going to give away. But I just want to put this out there in case people are washing the dishes or doing whatever. I'll give you another second to pause or fast forward if you don't want to hear anything about the show, but I want to kind of give us full freedom, Brad, to talk about whatever aspect of this that we want. So let's get into it. What did you think about The Paper?
So I'm a huge fan of the Office, both the British and the US version. The US version definitely has some disappointing valleys, but it's one of the most influential comedy series of all time, and I love it. I've lost count of how many times I've seen the series. I always throw it on in the background. It's one of my favorite shows of all time, and it's hilarious. So doing a spinoff really felt like a tall order, and I just wasn't sure that co-creator Greg Daniels was going to be able to pull it off. You know, it seemed like it was being forced, you know, even with the shift in perspective and following completely different characters, with the exception of, you know, one carryover from The Office. It just felt like, you know, we didn't really need that, and it'd be trying to capture lightning in a bottle again. But I was so taken aback by how much I fell in love with the show. It's a little slow to start in the first couple episodes to get kind of like the lay of the land and like figure out exactly how it's gonna unfold, and like how the tone is a little bit different from The Office despite the mockumentary angle, and just getting used to the characters and whatnot. But after the second episode, I was very charmed by it. I was very invested, and it that only increased as I kept watching the entire first season. I came to really like these characters. I'm invested in, you know, the dynamics, and I think my favorite part of it is how Greg Daniels and co-showrunner Michael Koeman have separated themselves from The Office with this show that also acts as a love letter to journalism. And I think that my favorite thing about it is how it does this like really sneaky thing of educating people who may not be familiar with how journalism works, especially small town journalism, and reminding people of like what the job of newspapers actually is supposed to be, since so many of them have been taken over by corporations that turn them into websites that just post clickbait headlines and things from news wires. And so establishing that and then showing this paper doing all the basic things that journalists are supposed to do, also educating people who don't understand the like journalism 101, you know, the fact that there are episodes about journalism and the five W's, you know, and the angle with, you know, the toilet paper company and like the corporate crossover that's there and the ethics involved with it. There are so many cool things that people probably never fully got a grasp on or understand, and things that have happened to their local newspapers, things that have happened on the larger media scale. That combined with a genuinely hilarious show, there's so many good jokes in the show and a fantastic ensemble of characters. I really just came to just love this show by the end of it, and I can't wait to see where it goes next, since they've already been renewed for a second season.
Yeah, I think trust and appreciation for journalism is probably at an all-time low in this country, and I do think that the show does a great job, like you said, of just kind of showing people what it could look like and showing people the importance of having a place that has the resources to report on what's going on in your backyard instead of just getting sucked into national culture wars and all this bullshit that a lot of people associate the media with kind of falling into and all that. I just think, yeah, the small town approach that this show takes really shows the value in that. And that it's not really a show that is trying so hard to do that. I think you kind of alluded to this. It's just like it's kind of a subtle thing. It's joke forward. It's story forward. And this journalism angle we're talking about is kind of like, it's in the background, you know, it's the foundation of the show in some ways, but it's not necessarily, it doesn't ever feel preachy in that way. So
yeah,
I think they got the balance right there. So what did you think about the season? I really like this show as well. I think there were like a few episodes that didn't quite hit for me in the same way that some of the highs did. But overall, I'm fully on board. I'm a really big fan of the show. And I thought it actually might have a stronger first season than both the American version of The Office and Parks and Rec, because those shows famously kind of got out of the gate a little slowly and stumbled a little bit and kind of had to take a little while to find their lane and find fine tune their characters and get everything on the right page, you know? So what did you think about how this show worked in its first season compared to how those shows did it?
No, I fully agree. I think that they've managed to figure out the identity of the show much quicker than they did with The Office or Parks and Rec. You know, The Office suffered from the fact that that first season's only 6 episodes, and it's basically a carbon copy of the first season of The British Office with just American versions of the characters. And that's why it didn't really hit so well. But once they figured out that in the second season they could make Michael Scott a lovable dimwit rather than making him more of a clueless prick like Ricky Gervais's character is in the UK Office, that's when they really tapped into something special there, and they figured out like the US identity of The Office. And Parks and Rec had a similar struggle where the first season kind of made Leslie Knope a female Michael Scott in a way. She kind of wasn't sure of herself. She was, you know, a bit of a bumbling, you know, local government character. But then they realized, oh no, it's a lot better if she's this strong, smart, put together character, and everyone else around her kind of makes things worse in some capacity. Mm-hmm. And I think that this show really feels like it had all the characters figured out. And really, it probably just comes from the experience that, you know, Greg Daniels did have on The Office and Parks and Rec, and knowing how to do it this time and what he needed to do different to set itself apart sooner than the other shows. And so I think that having like that template to start with, and then having the comedic tone be slightly different, because this, it does feel more like a workplace sitcom, and it lacks the same kind of authenticity that The Office had. Like The Office felt more real. This has a slightly more sitcom feel to it, but not in a way that is like super exaggerated. I would say the one character that probably feels like the most sitcom-y is probably Esmeralda. And and that's not bad, because she's still pretty funny, but she is still, you know, even more cartoonish and I think silly than Michael Scott was when he was at his best. You know, that changed kind of as the Office seasons went on and it went longer. But I think overall the show really does a good job of knowing what it's trying to accomplish with it, both with its characters and like what the core of the show is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Esmeralda. She's played by Sabrina Impacciatore from the second season of White Lotus. That's probably where a lot of people would know her from. And that's the one character that I kind of bumped on a little bit in the season. There are moments where she is great, but I would say the biggest source of my issues with the paper season one kind of stem from her, and not necessarily that actress or her performance, but the way that character is written and that kind of larger than life, super heightened characterization that's going on there that kind of feels like it's from a different show in some ways. So how did that character work for you overall?
For the most part, I liked her. I liked her more as the show went on. I would say her and Tim Key's character were the characters that I liked the least, but they're also meant to be somewhat unlikable. It's interesting because Esmeralda is kind of both the Dwight Schrute and the Michael Scott of the paper in a way. But there are some things that she has that are really funny. but like when they have an entire episode that was like dedicated to her being catfished, I was like, this feels like just like a little much. And that was when like I felt like this, it was getting too network sitcom-y, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't hate her as a character necessarily. I think that they maybe need to reel her in a little bit, because it feels like she is, it's a little too much, you know, for the style of the show. And I think my issue with Tim Key's character was that it kind of felt like they inserted a version of Ricky Gervais's character into the paper. And Tim Key does a good job with the character, playing that character. He's a hilarious British comedian. I love him as a performer. But it's the character that is grating, and he's doing a good job because that character is supposed to be grating. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, yeah, I don't know. If there was one thing that needed to be retooled, I would say it's the Esmeralda's like level of, you know, exaggeration as far as her character is concerned.
Do you watch Abbott Elementary?
I do.
So she reminded me a little bit of Ava Coleman, the principal on that show, and how that character started out as almost an antagonist in some ways. She's like this kind of clueless character who has this position of power, and everybody knows she doesn't really deserve it. And that's kind of how Esmeralda is in the very, very beginning of this show. And throughout this first season, she's kind of in, not necessarily full-on villain mode, but she's kind of trying to sabotage Donald Gleason's character, Ned Sampson, the new editor-in-chief of the Toledo Truth Teller, I think is the name of the newspaper. So she's kind of like looking for ways to stab people in the back and all of that. And it just reminded me a little bit of the dynamic in Abbott Elementary that the Ava character has with the rest of that show's cast. And my wife and I were theorizing that maybe the paper is going to try to put Esmeralda on that same type of trajectory, where like a few seasons from now, we're almost going to look back at this and be like, wow, I can't believe Esmeralda started here, because she's changed so much and she's become more a softer character in some ways. Do you know what I mean? Like more integrated in with the cast in a way that everybody feels more friendly than antagonistic. I wonder what you think about that idea.
No, I think that's perfectly fine. You know, and that's the great thing about TV shows is you can give your characters room to grow and change and figure stuff out. And, you know, even when you look back at The Office, you know, a character like Dwight, who was pretty insufferable for those first few seasons, you do start to care about him as it goes on when he, you know, has his big breakup with Angela and gets depressed and whatnot. And, you know, that was a character that people came to love in spite of his character flaws. And I think that definitely is something that could easily happen with Esmeralda on the paper.
Yeah. So I mentioned Donald Gleason. He's the ostensibly the lead of this show, even though it's definitely an ensemble. So maybe we can use this as an opportunity to talk about the romantic subplots of this season, which are Ned and Mare Pretty, who is played by Chelsea Free, I think is how you pronounce her name. I was totally unfamiliar with her as an actress, and I thought she was great in this season.
Same.
And then also there is Melvin Gregg and Ramona Young, who play Detrick and Nicole. And so there's kind of two versions of these couples or burgeoning couples, if you like, that audiences can kind of like ping pong their interests back and forth to as the writers play those relationships in different highs and lows. So I thought that was smart to have two different versions going. And I guess the original Office did this to a degree. There's obviously the Jim and Pam thing that was the primary thing, but also Dwight and Angela is like a relationship that eventually we came to care about. But I really cared about what was going on with Detrick and Nicole almost as much as I cared about Ned and Mare. So what did you think about the romance of the show and all of the dynamics between those characters?
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised that they came out of the gate with two romances at the same time. So it did take a while for the Dwight-Angela romance to really blossom into like a bigger part of the show. Even though, you know, there was like little hints of it and like slow development of it. But yeah, here, you know, the one with Melvin Gregg and Ramona Young is pretty much front and center, along with the Jim and Pam proxy relationship between Ned and Mare. And yeah, I like both of them. I liked the one between Detrick and what is Ramona Young's character's name again?
Nicole. Yeah.
Nicole. Yeah. Because it's, obviously Mayer and Ned are, you know, meant to be slightly older characters. And then so there's, you have something for like the younger generation. And that dynamic is interesting because it's one where they're like, they're kind of still learning like the ropes of like how a relationship should work. And it's like, it's a little bit immature and there's a lot of room for growth there for them to figure it out. And obviously, you know, despite what, you know, Nicole says and seemingly, you know, thinks that she wants, there's obviously real feelings there. And it's be interesting to see how that develops. And then with the Ned and Mayer relationship, I'm very curious about that because they move faster than Jim and Pam. Jim and Pam don't have their, you know, kiss until the end of season two. And there was still even like a, you know, will they, won't they after that into season three. And so I feel like they'll still have that. Well, they won't, because they have to maintain that professional dynamic, but it'll probably play out in a different way than we're expecting.
Yeah. This is another part of the show that reminded me a little bit of Abbott Elementary, where like you've got the Janine and Gregory relationship that kind of like you're immediately pulling for those characters to get together. And then there are obstacles that are thrown in the way, even though you know that both of those characters are interested in each other. And you spend effectively a whole season with them kind of like being apart in various capacities. And I think they're just going to do the same thing with the paper season two, where they're going to try to keep Ned and Mare apart for those professional reasons, like you said. But like, that's another thing where the audience definitely wants to see them together. So that's, it just puts the show in an interesting position earlier in the timeline than something like The Office or even Abbott. I think even Abbott waited a little while longer to get that going. So just a fascinating structural decision, I guess. Is there anything else from the show that we should talk about? There's so much to talk about. They dropped all 10 episodes at once. So like, there's just like a lot of plot stuff going on there, and we don't necessarily have to get into that, but any kind of bigger picture takeaways that you have or aspects of the show, you know, if you want to talk about Oscar and his role in the show, we can do that. Like, where do you think we should guide the conversation next?
Yeah, I mean, I think Oscar is a good thing to talk about, because that was one thing I it was easy to see how a character like that would fit into the dynamic of a local newspaper. I wasn't sure how he would be utilized. And honestly, I think Oscar's personality kind of fits maybe even a little better in an environment like this, because he's a little bit full of himself. And, you know, he was always, you know, thinking that he was a smart character. And so having him work at a newspaper and, you know, getting caught up in like building it up and everything seems like something that would be, you know, become important to him. And he has the right mindset for. And I do like the initially antagonistic relationship he has with the documentary crew, of just being so mad that they're there and trying to sabotage them. It's the end of the first episode is hilarious when he's just spouting off various vulgarities that they have to bleep. And if you watch too, one of the cast members in the background starts to laugh because like they just can't hold anymore because of all the things that he's saying, which is great. But yeah, it's and I like the little. It's a great conduit to allow for the sparing nods that there are to the original Office. I really loved the thing when he kind of like peeks into the conference room cautiously, and it's just like, I don't have a good relationship, you know, with a conference room meetings and stuff like that. So yeah, there was nice little nods here and there, and they didn't feel like they were shoehorned in. I'm glad they don't do them all the time. You know, it's little stuff, and having Oscar there does work for the show.
Yeah, I'm glad that antagonistic relationship he had with the camera crew was basically forgotten about after whatever it is, three episodes or something, because I think that could have gotten pretty old pretty quickly, because he would have just been like, why is he even here? Why is he participating in this? You know, kind of what we said with the references, too. It's not like, hey, look, this is tied to The Office, you know, in kind of an obnoxious way. It feels like confident. They're doing their own thing. And yes, there's the occasional reference to The Office, but I liked those because they were so infrequent. Like when at the very end, when he's talking about taking 100% of the or missing 100% of the shots you don't take, or whatever the Michael Scott, Wayne Gretzky quote was from The Office, that was like a nice little moment that put a smile on my face instead of having me roll my eyes like I do so often with so many of these like, hey, remember this kind of things, you know, because the show does that so infrequently. It made me smile instead of be super annoyed with it. So, I really appreciated the way they went about all that. Anything else we should touch on before we wrap it up here?
One thing that I'm interested to see if they expand it or if they just kind of used it as a nice way to like set the stage for the show in general is I'm wondering if they'll keep doing newsreel flashbacks.
Yeah.
Like the little black and white documentary footage showing Tracy Letts as the original, you know, editor in chief of the Toledo Truth Teller. Cause I thought that that was a nice touch. And it helped lean into the idea of like, this is what newspapers used to be. This is when, you know, newspapers used to matter and like real information mattered. And I'm curious to see if like they have a way and a plan to like keep that element as like, kind of like a cherry on top of like a way of like kind of just giving an extra boost to the thematic elements of the show and, you know, show even more so of like what Greg Daniels is trying to do as far as like this, you know, tribute to journalism, basically.
Yeah, I was surprised that because that begins the show or happens pretty early on in the first episode. And I was surprised that the series kind of dropped that for a while, and then it picked it back up a couple other times throughout the course of that first season. But I was kind of thinking that was going to be something that appeared in every single episode, and obviously that wasn't the case. But I think I would like it if, I mean, more Tracy Letts in most situations is a good thing. So,
of course.
I think that's a cool little thing, and I could see them going either way. I could see them trying to continue that moving forward, or them just being like, oh, this was a little experiment that we tried in season one and it just didn't really do anything for us, so we're just moving on from that entirely. So yeah, I really enjoyed this show. I was surprised at how much I liked it, and I am definitely eager to see what they do in season two. I had a chance to talk with Melvin Gregg and Ramona Young just for 5 minutes, so it's a very quick interview. So before I throw it to that, any closing thoughts about the paper season one, Brad?
Do you have a favorite joke that sticks out in your mind right now from the first season?
Oh, man, that's a good question. I really liked Tim Key's performance. I think I liked that character a little bit more than you did. So yeah, I don't have a specific line read or anything like that, but I think it probably would have been something that he said that made me laugh the hardest. Is there something that stands out for you?
So there's two that I really love. One that made me laugh, and one of my friends who watched it with me, who loves The Office just as much as I do, so hard. And it's a Melvin Gregg line, and I forget what the lead in is, but he's talking about his grandma being in a nursing home, and he's like, yeah, like if someone mistreats my grandma at the nursing home, we get a discount that month. And it's such a funny, like, perfectly middle class thing, because it's like, oh, we don't take her out of that nursing home, we just get a discount that month. I laughed so hard at that joke. And then the other one is actually in the first episode I really liked, and they kind of brush over it really quickly, but it's a really charming line too. And it's when Ned is talking of like being excited about starting at the newspaper, and he says, you know, I love, you know, the old school journalism ways of like having a whiskey and a cigar with, you know, with sources and stuff like that. It's one of my weaknesses. And he's like, also romanticizing things, I'm told. Yeah. It's one of my weaknesses.
Yeah, that was really funny too. Yeah. We didn't really talk about Donald Gleason much in this conversation, but I thought he was really great in the show. I was kind of surprised at like the broader critical response to the paper, because I think people are maybe a little bit more down on it or more mixed on it than it sounds like we are. And I think some folks maybe have an issue with Donald Gleason as the lead of the show, but I thought he was great. So
yeah, I like him. I think he's a very charming, you know, he's just awkward enough, you know, but he's still competent. You know, he does have a little bit of the gym vibe about him, but yeah, I think it's a good performance. I really like him in the show.
Yeah. Oh, one last thing, and this is like a tiny thing, but I don't envision a scenario ever coming up where I would be able to talk about this with anybody else. So there's a moment in one of these episodes where Ned is talking about, it's the episode where Esmeralda gets catfished. And so Josh Holloway from Lost plays a role in that show. And there's a moment where Ned is trying to comfort her, and he says something like, it's okay, they were all dead anyway, like talking about the cast of Lost. And that is not true. That's not what happens on Lost. That's like one of my big pet peeves, that like the internet has kind of taken that to be gospel basically at this point for like people who didn't actually watch Lost. That's just the pervasive idea that a lot of people have about what happened at the end of Lost. That's not true. So I actually tried to reach out to the writer of that episode to see if I could get her to comment on it, on whether or not that is like a misunderstanding that the writer of this episode had, or if that's a character moment that something worse, if we're supposed to glean something from Ned's character, from him being the person to say that, because typically when the lead of a show says something, you're kind of supposed to be on their side, right? Like in a show like this, not in, you know, Succession or something like that, but like in a scenario like this, I think it's a broad generalization, but I think we're supposed to kind of relate to them and be like, think that what they are saying is a true thing. And that was just a not true thing that I was wondering if that's supposed to be like a little character moment of like, Ned is the type of guy who didn't actually watch Lost, but just read something about it and kind of internalized it. And he's trying to do the right thing and comfort Esmeralda in that moment. But anyway, that was just one little moment that I kind of like hyper fixated on and was like, is this intentional or does the writer of this episode really think that that's how Lost ended? So anyway, thank you for indulging my nonsense, Brad. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And to comment on it, I honestly think it's one of those things where like, because the finale was confusing for a lot of people, even those who were obsessed with the show. And I think that if anything, like it wouldn't necessarily be the kind of thing where like he's wrong for thinking that. But also, I think it's the kind of thing where maybe he didn't even watch the show, and like that's just something he picked up from pop culture osmosis, because there are so many people who think that. And honestly, there are a lot of jokes about that, you know, about the finale, about like you know, people being confused about it and then maybe being dead or in purgatory the whole time or something like that. So I think that it still works, and it doesn't necessarily make him any less trustworthy. It just means that Lost wasn't something that he, you know, was attuned to, you know, in his life, and doesn't actually know what the finale of the show was.
Yeah, I think the charitable read that I had was that he's just like a, you know, he's not as all-knowing as you might expect another character in that position to be. He is like a little fallible here and there, even though his heart is in the right place and he definitely has like a passion for doing things right. Like that episode where he makes everybody test out all the products, even though they're going to do the, you know, write the article about, like, they're trying to be like the wire cutter of Toledo, basically. So, you know, he definitely has like his ethics in the right place for the most part.
But he also, and he's fallible too, because like in the episode where they go to the mattress store too, like he doesn't know how to like play it cool and like put up a front, like to try and get the information that they need. You know, he totally messes it up.
Yeah, that might be one of my favorite jokes, actually, now that you mentioned that. When they go in and they're talking about, like, he and Mare are talking about what their approach is going to be going into the mattress store and what they're going to say. And then he goes in and just, like, completely screws things up and, like, talks about his mom, I think, and, like, just completely blows it. And the way that the Mare kind of does that, like, Jim from The Office look to camera thing, even though that's, like, a familiar joke structure or whatever, I just think it works really, really well in this context. So
she has some great looks to the camera that are just like, Jim tried to be like a little subtle and sneaky about it, but like when she does it, she's just like, what the fuck's going on?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's wrap things up, and here is my conversation with Melvin Gregg and Ramoni Young, who play Detrick and Nicole. There are a lot of really larger-than-life characters in the mix here, but your characters stand out as being pretty down-to-earth in a bit of a heightened world. And I was wondering if it was ever challenging to modulate your performances and maybe dial things back a little compared with what people like Tim or Sabrina were doing.
I kind of love that about my character. I really wanted to play a character because I'm used to, I guess, playing bigger characters, and whether it's like super big or super small. So I just wanted to do something that was really grounded. And I think it's nice to just react honestly to other actors that are bigger on the show.
What do you think, Melvin?
Yeah, I think you kind of need a mixed bunch of people, you know, and coming in, understanding who I wanted my character to be, I couldn't really shift it based on who their characters are. I mean, it's natural to have situations where you may match the energy of the people you're around, but the base level of who my character is more, you know, unsure, so he's not going to go out and be more bold with his actions or statements or whatever. So I think just kind of understanding who our characters are was the most important.
Yeah. Without saying The Office, was there anything that either of you watched that helped inspire or inform your work on this show?
For me, I did a show called American Vandal, which was a mockumentary. So I lived in the same space of just this format. So coming from doing something similar, I kind of had a level of comfort with it. I think definitely think that helped prepare me for this.
I watched a lot of early Simpsons just 'cause.
Was there anything from there that stood out to you or kind of helped you specifically?
I
I was trying to figure it out for you. Like,
It was just a very relaxed
it was
show to watch.
small town.
Small town.
Okay, there you go.
Okay.
Do you remember if there was a scene or a moment that took way longer than it should have to get right because people were laughing or something like that on set?
Yeah, I don't remember the like specifics, but I do remember it was a conference scene where we were taking forever to get it done because we were just kind of delirious at the end of the day. So our like it was just kind of a lot. We were laughing, we were being very childlike, I would say. It was fun, but I don't think the crew and the director liked it as much.
Yeah, in the conference rooms, there's just a lot of funny people in a really tight glass space.
Yeah. Well, kind of going back to what you guys were saying earlier, I remember reading a lot about the making of The Office and how those actors who were cast in that show brought so much of themselves to those particular roles. And it sounds like from just the couple minutes that I've had with you guys so far that you were able to do something similar with this show. Was that something that you talked with Greg and Michael about early on, or what were those early conversations like about you and your characters?
I specifically wanted to go against type. I feel like I've been cast based off of people's idea of me a lot of times, and that comes off of like prior work. So things kind of blend in together in a sense. And with this project, I feel like I had not I felt like, but I had more freedom over the character. Like when we got the breakdown in the audition, there was no breakdown. It was just the size. So we got to bring to the character what we thought made the most sense. And if they liked it, we got cast. And then from there, they wrote around it. So I didn't pull a lot from personally who I am. I wanted to go against type, but I pulled from personal experiences within the story.
Okay, what about you, Ramona?
Greg Daniels and Michael Koman, they're always super, they've been really open and receptive to ideas and suggestions, and they're so supportive and encouraging. At the same time, they've like thought of everything and they've written everything out and they're so meticulous, but they've always brought like an energy of, yeah, if you ever feel like anything, if you ever have any thoughts, like just, let us know. And they've always been so kind about that. And it's not always like that on shows.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I really enjoyed the show so far. So thank you so much. And I look forward to hopefully talking to you guys next season.
Nice to meet you.
Take care. All right, Chris, I've got you back here to talk about Highest to Lowest, Spike Lee's latest movie. This film is streaming on Apple TV Plus right now. It's a reinterpretation of Akira Kurosawa's High and Low. And I believe it's an adaptation of a novel called King's Ransom that High and Low was also based on. So this movie stars Denzel Washington. It stars Jeffrey Wright. It's about a music mogul who's who he thinks his son has been kidnapped, and it turns out that the son of his driver has been kidnapped, and he has to decide whether or not he's going to pay the ransom for this teenage boy, basically. And he's at a very important point financially in his life where there's a lot at stake, and it's not as easy as him just forking over the cash. There's like a moral dilemma at the center of the story. So that's the basic setup. What did you think about Highest to Lowest, Chris?
I thought it was pretty good. I have some issues with it. I wrote our review at slashfilm.com. My biggest issue with it is it has this very weird musical score that's like really distracting and really obvious, and I don't understand why it's there. And it kind of like levels off as the film goes on, but like for the first like 45 minutes or so, it's so like blaring and glaringly distracting that I was like, what is going on here? Why is the score here? Like, it just sounds like it's from a different movie. Also, like, Dean Winters is in the movie, aka the Mayhem guy. And I've seen him in other things, and I think he's fine in other things. Like, he was on 30 Rock, and I think he's funny on 30 Rock. But he is really bad in this movie. And every time he shows up, he's just like, he's there for comic relief. And I was like, I hate this guy. Like, get out of the movie. You're ruining the movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, those are the negatives. But at the same time, like, Spike Lee is a great filmmaker. He still has got the chops. Denzel Washington, one of the best of the best. I just love watching Denzel Washington work, man. I just love him doing his thing. And there are multiple moments in this movie where he's just doing his thing. And I just love to watch Denzel Washington deliver lines. Like there's no one else right now doing it like Denzel Washington. So, you know, I have issues with it. High to Low is much, much better. But in the end, I thought this was pretty good. You know, it's not the best Spike Lee movie. I wish it had a different musical score, but I thought it was overall good.
That score is so bizarre, man. It sounds like an instrumental track from Hamilton or something. Like, there's this incredible piano and orchestra, and it's like really cool music on its own, but you're right. It just does not fit with the tone of what's going on in this movie. It's like, it's too triumphant and jaunty even. And there is a long stretch of this movie where there's an exchange that's supposed to be made, where Denzel is supposed to go and drop off, I think it's $17.5 million to somebody later in the movie. And it's like one of the big set pieces of the film. He gets on a subway and there's just this whole thing building up, and that song or that track or whatever you want to call it is playing, and it just feels like it repeats a million times. And it's just, what is this musical choice? And there's also the decision to have a Puerto Rican parade or something happening, like to celebrate New York's Puerto Rican pride or something like that going on. And so the movie just stops for a while, and there's a band that's playing on the streets. And like, I don't know, it's been a while since I've seen a Spike Lee movie. Does that seem like a hallmark of his work? Is he interested in music to that degree where his movies will just stop and he'll showcase performances like that? Or was that just something that happened in this film?
I mean, kind of. There is stuff like that in his other movies, but it is kind of extreme here. There is like a thing at the very end. There's a very extended musical number, and I was like, this should have been cut, man. I was ready for the movie to end at that point. I was like, I do not need this to be in the movie. Like, it just kept going and going. I was like, this is killing the movie. Like, I don't need it. Like,
yeah.
So yeah, I like a lot of stuff in the movie. There's just like some really weird choices here that I just don't quite get why he made them.
Yeah, the bones of this story are so good. And I love the idea of transposing the narrative over into New York City instead of Japan, and having it be like take place in the music business instead of, I believe, Toshiro Mifune's character in High and Low is like a shoe salesman or something, or a shoe company executive. And so the ideas of this movie kind of on paper look great. And I think, and in the execution, visually, this movie is gorgeous. So I feel like this is one of the best looking Spike Lee movies that I've seen. I have not seen all of his work, but I thought the movie looked incredible. But there's something about the casting decisions and the script here that just didn't quite do it for me. It wasn't just Dean Winters. It felt like Denzel Washington and Jeffrey Wright And even like Rick Fox, who the former NBA basketball player who shows up playing himself in a small role, those guys were on such a different plane of acting than everybody else. And obviously Denzel and Jeffrey Wright were way above Rick Fox. I'm just kind of bringing up Rick Fox's name to illustrate the point that even characters like Denzel's character's wife and his son and all of the other cops in this movie are just, they feel like they're in a high school stage production or something instead of feeling like they're in a movie. And there's just something about Denzel and Jeffrey Wright, these veterans who inhabit their characters in a way that feels real and believable, and you're invested in what's happening to them. And everybody else, as soon as anybody else in this movie opens their mouth, pretty much, it's just like, oh God, I just like it. I'm immediately yanked out of the movie because it just feels amateur. And I'm sorry that sounds harsh and mean, but that's how I felt. Did you feel that way about any other performers, or was that just something that I bumped against?
No, I know exactly what you're talking about. The cop characters in particular feel really strange and out of place. Like, I don't know if like he's just trying to highlight the fact that cops suck, which, you know, I agree, cops do suck, but like it's like they suck really hard in this movie, where they're just like, they're constantly like arguing with Jeffrey Wright's character, and it's like, dial it down a little bit. Like, I don't know what's going on here with these characters.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, I should say that everything that I just said about the acting does not apply to A$AP Rocky, who I thought was pretty good.
He's a really good
role, but
there's a scene where him and Denzel have this like face to face where he's in a recording booth and Denzel's on the other side of the recording booth, and they're having this like back and forth. And like, I thought that was like great. Like, they were like, the fact that he could handle himself so well against Denzel Washington, it was like very impressive. I was like, wow, yeah, this guy is a very good actor. I want to see him in more things.
Yeah, 100%. Are there any other aspects of this movie that you want to highlight? I feel like I came away from this with a little bit more negativity than positivity, even though like Denzel's performance was really good. I thought Jeffrey Wright was very, very good in this movie, like very torn and kind of emotionally on edge. And he just feels like he has this negative relationship with the police because I believe he's supposed to be an ex-con in the movie. And that maybe explains a little bit of the tension. And I think it might be just because they're judging him for his past in a way that they're not judging Denzel's character, who is this like famous music mogul or whatever. But I thought he was like lights out in this movie, just really, really excellent. But are there any other performances or moments or ideas that this film gets at that you think are worth touching on here?
You know, do we want to go into spoilers, or is that okay?
I think, you know, this is going to be the last segment of the podcast. So if you have not seen Highest to Lowest and are still interested in it, check it out on Apple TV Plus. And I'm giving people who are washing the dishes or driving or whatever just a couple extra seconds to pause or fast forward, or you can end the episode now. But yeah, let's go ahead and go into spoiler territory. So final warning, full spoilers for Highest to Lowest starting right now. Go ahead, Chris.
I do like that Denzel ultimately turns down that offer from Young Felon. Like, he could have taken it, and there is like a version of this movie that ends with him like being like, all right, I'm gonna take it, but like, he's, you know, he has that like, not all money is good money. At the same time, this movie also does feel very much like an older man's like fantasy, like Spike Lee's fantasy of being like, I'm never going to retire. Like, I'm at the top of my game still. Like, no one can tell me. Like, this movie is filled with scenes where people are being like, this guy has the greatest ears in the business. So it's like, it does. There's a part of me that like, but it's like, you know, I'm not doubting Spike Lee. I do think Spike Lee is one of the best. And, you know, I'm not doubting Denzel Washington. I do think he is one of the best. But I do think there is kind of like a fantasy built into this movie where it's about older men who refuse to hand the reins over to a younger generation.
That's absolutely in there. And he talks about AI a couple times. And like, I think the movie kind of conflates AI with just shifting audience interests in music, because the idea in this movie is that Denzel's character was like a huge deal in the early 2000s, and he's kind of, his company has kind of fallen off in recent years, and he has not been as interested in the music side of it because he's been focusing too much on the business side of it. And I think, yeah, there's definitely something in there about like there could have been, I think another movie could have gone the route of like, even if Denzel doesn't take the deal from Young Felon, he could have embraced hip hop in a way, you know, music that sounds similar or something. And I think the movie would have felt less old man screams at cloud or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And instead there's that performance at the very end, which is like impressive. And I thought it was very well done. It was well staged and all of that, but like it kind of feels unrealistic in a way, you know, like you're telling me that this is going to be the direction that you're going to go to launch a new label or something. And like, you think that's going to be a successful way to kind of cut through the noise in the music industry right now. I'm not quite sure about that, but it's definitely, it's more about what Spike Lee is trying to say about, yes, like stick with your, you know, go with your gut, follow your instinct. And there are human qualities to that that I find admirable, but I'm just not sure about the actual practicalities of that, I guess.
Yeah, like, yeah, I'm right there with you. That's well said. Yeah.
Anything else that we can talk about? Oh, what did you think about the New Yorkness of it all? Obviously, Spike Lee is like the premier New York filmmaker. I think that maybe that's fair to say. And this movie just goes out of its way to, the whole opening credits is like these sweeping drone shots of the city, which is all fine and well. And then there are several moments where Spike Lee just goes out of his way to be like, Boston sucks. Like his sports, his love of sports and stuff bleeds through into this movie, where to the point where a character like screams at the camera about how much Boston is terrible, and he clearly hates the Boston Celtics and is just doing this because he's a big fan of New York City. So like, is that one of those things where you're just like, oh man, there he goes again, Spike Lee, he's just out there doing his thing, you know, he loves New York, what are you gonna do, that old scamp, he's out there, you know, you gotta love him? Or is that something where you're like, Jesus Christ, Spike, come on man, how many times are you gonna say this? Like, is there where do you fall on that spectrum?
The only issue I had, like, what, you know, I think it's great, you know, I love Spike Lee's love of New York. The only issue I have is that he has multiple characters refer to the Bronx as the boogie down Bronx. And it's like, I really don't think, and like, these are characters who don't know each other. And it's like, I really don't think all of these people would be calling it that. Like, I think it's like, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe everyone in New York calls the Bronx the boogie down Bronx. I don't know. But I find it distracting when like, he has like three different people and like, there's like a newspaper headline that calls it that. It's like, I don't think that's accurate, but maybe someone can correct me. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, that kind of seems like a Spike Lee Instagram caption come to life. You know, like,
yes.
If you've ever followed him on Instagram, he just uses these like, it's just an incredible use of the English language, watching him work in that medium in particular. And that kind of felt like that bled over into the script in some way. And it felt very personal. And I'm so torn about it because on one hand, it's kind of obnoxious, but on the other hand, I kind of just appreciate it because it gives his movie a distinctive nature. You know, there's a flair to it. There's a unique stamp on it that nobody else is doing. So I kind of have to respect that, while at the same time maybe thinking it's okay that he goes so far sometimes that it's pretty over the top. But I guess that's where I shake out on that. All right. Any closing thoughts on Highest to Lowest before we wrap it up here?
I guess my only closing thought is that it is kind of a bummer that we live in an era where a Spike Lee movie only gets like a very limited theatrical release and then goes right to streaming. Like,
yeah,
man, it kind of sucks that that's where we are. Like, Spike Lee, he's a legendary filmmaker. And like, now we got to deal with like his movie having a very, very limited, very short theatrical run before it hits streaming on a streaming service not a lot of people have. It's like,
yeah,
that's where we are.
And Denzel is like a major star still. Like, those Equalizer movies make a ton of money. So this conceivably, if it got a wide release, could have been a lifeline that theaters really needed at the end of August and the beginning of September. You know, like, I just think there was definitely the opportunity there, but that's not really in Apple's game plan. So it's just, very much like, this is the new reality of where we are right now with this weird in-between space that where these streaming companies are greenlighting movies. Like, I'm happy this movie exists, even though I didn't love it. But yeah, it just it I feel like they're leaving money on the table. But I don't know. They must know something we don't. But
yeah.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Chris. I appreciate it.
Sure.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the show. You can find more about some of the stories we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com, and I will link to several things in the show notes as well. You can subscribe to Slash Film Weekly on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really, really does help us out a lot. It helps us get in front of more listeners, which is definitely something we need. Thanks so much for listening, everyone, and we'll talk to you next week.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply, in-app only.